The most wonderful thing about another's looking at us with love is not only what we discover in this look about the soul and the love of this other person, but what we learn about ourselves. This look of love is actually a mirror in which one sees oneself being seen, to use the apt formula of Lancer del Vasto. There are looks in which we see ourselves as contemptible, as some trifling quantity. When we are looked at with love, we discover that we are lovable in the strongest sense of the word, capable of arousing love in the heart of another. A mirror such as this tells us about ourselves, but not the way an inanimate and impassible mirror does. It speaks to us through the joy, astonishment, love, and elan awakened in this other being at the sight of our inner self, and which the look of the other reveals to us. It is a deeply moving experience to discover that we are worthy of being loved, capable of making love well up in another's heart like a spring from a rock. How can we help being reconciled with ourselves? Love, esteem, self-respect, sentiments either unknown or at least scarcely burgeoning until then and very often warped, at that, now spring up within us, and make us suddenly aware of our dignity. From that moment, we know that we have a reason for being, since we exist for someone else. But there is something even more wonderful. This is the look of a Christian who discerns, in the light of Christ, that our innermost self is the soul of a child of God. He learns our eternal name spoken by God from all eternity, the name that brought us into being in the divine mind before we were called into existence. This look has the very poignant quality of being completely transparent to God's own gaze at us, so that we discover in it the measure of God's love for us. I am certain that God would want every man and woman to encounter such a look at least once in his or her life. But even those who love us most cannot always be actively loving. Their looks of love, and I am speaking, above all, of the soul's gaze, are privileged and intermittent moments. Where God is concerned, we can be sure that He is always in the act of loving. This act, this fervent attention, is His presence of love to our soul. Wonderment, 2. Yes, God finds delight in the soul of His child, amazing as it may seem, because in this soul His gaze sees what is more real than its own being. He sees the soul's eternal divine name. God's look of love is more efficacious than any human look. This divine gaze creates holiness, and is a communication of divine life. If God's look of love is to produce its effects, the soul must be receptive, opening up its depths to it by an act of faith. This must be the faith of the man who acknowledges the love of his God for him, an active love, love in act. If this faith were fervent and not intermittent, God's look of love would never cease making the soul grow in holiness, just as the sun makes the crops ripen. To pray is to become aware that God is looking at us with love. It is to open ourselves through faith to His creative, regenerative, divinizing and beatifying action. Then love for God, Shanti, wells up in the soul. To pray well, we must believe that God looks with love at each and every one of us. He looked at him with love, Mk 10:21. 14. If God stopped thinking about me. You ask, am I right to believe that if God stopped thinking about me for a single instant, I would cease to exist? Is that an error? I would be very sad if it were, because since this idea came to me one day during mental prayer, I have felt so much closer to the Lord. More precisely, I have sensed Him so much closer to me. Have no fear at all. What you have understood is perfectly orthodox. Everything that exists has been created by God, and is preserved in existence by Him. Hence, nothing exists that is not willed Him, willed not once and for all, but at every instant. So, there is nothing that has not been thought by Him, since nothing can be willed unless it has first been thought. If God ceased to preserve a being in existence, this being would immediately fall back into non-existence. The same would happen if He stopped willing it or thinking of it. Now I hope that you are completely reassured. You should note, however, that while it is not an error to distinguish between thought, will, and act in God, we must understand that this is a human way of speaking. God thinks, wills, and acts in one selfsame action. I can clearly grasp this sentiment of God's proximity that your idea awakened in you. When someone thinks about us, he or she becomes more present to us than through physical proximity. The latter can only be corporeal. I am reminded of a wife living with a husband who is no more present to her than if he were living at the Antipodes. Presence and absence are first of all of the spiritual order. But follow the truth you have glimpsed, to its ultimate conclusion. Understand that God has been thinking about you for all eternity. Your coming into existence was simply the realization in time of this eternal thought, which is a thought of love. God had forever cherished this thought when he created you. You incarnate God's thought. You are his thought, but in the embryonic state. Life is given to you, and grace is operating in you, so that it may attain its plenitude. Indeed, God can think and will only a perfect being, one that has attained plenitude. The divine thought that you are, is therefore the thought of a saint, like no other saint, for two identical thoughts never spring up in God. By cooperating with God's work within you, you will become the saint that God delighted in inventing from all eternity. 15. I will become a torrent. Your letter touched me deeply, especially this part: why don't you ever write for poor miserable sinners? Please have a little pity on those who cannot pray to God with the prayer of the just, and tell them if it is true that they are not excluded from the kingdom of prayer. I must have expressed myself very badly in my earlier letters, if I gave you to believe that they were the letters of a just man addressing other just men. To begin with, I find it very difficult to accept your distinctions. Can anyone claim to be just? Is there anyone who is not a sinner? Who can attempt to pray without first confessing his sin, and avowing his repentance? And what wretchedness can discourage God? I am reminded of a certain young woman who was extraordinarily beautiful and passionately loved. She was dismayed beyond words when her surgeon gave her a most disturbing diagnosis of a tiny, harmless-looking pimple at the corner of her lip. If her beauty were impaired, would she still be loved? The same sort of anxiety sometimes occurs in individuals aware of their moral ugliness. They can stop worrying. Even though it takes beauty or goodness to awaken love in a human heart, the same does not hold true for God. God's love is of an entirely different nature. Saint Paul was well aware of this, and designated it by a word not currently used before him, agape, which has been translated by the word charity. It is not the sight of a creature's lovableness that arouses God's love. It is his own love that creates the lovableness, the beauty, and the goodness of the being he loves. Because we are sinners, we are distraught at having lost the moral beauty that earned for us the esteem of others and above all, our own self-esteem, and we imagine that God also turns away from us. As if our virtue had won us his love up to now. As if man could capture God's esteem, or awaken his love. God's love for us does not have its origin in us. Neither our virtues nor our wretchedness can influence God's love. His love is not motivated from outside himself. It is a spontaneous swelling up, an overflowing of riches, a creative dynamism. God is not searching for human values to love. He is seeking out the poor man in the biblical sense of the term, the sinner, the fool, the weakling, the one in whom he finds a void to fill. But the sinner is unaware of this quality of God's love, and thinks that God has made a mistake. Like Saint Peter, he protests, "Leave me, Lord. I am a sinful man." LK 5:8. Well, God will not go away, and the sinner's wretchedness will become the monstrance of his love. This is why the sinner's prayer consists, above all, in an unshakable belief in this absolute gratuitousness of God's love, and in consenting to it without pusillanimity. It seems wonderfully simple, but often turns out to be very difficult. Our need to be loved by God for our own excellence is very deep-seated and tenacious. It is often unavowed, and unknown to ourselves. The proof of this is the bitter vexation that perturbs our interior life when we have succumbed to temptation. In our relations with God, we must radically fight this tendency to see His love as the recognition of our own value. The reason God does not protect us from every failure is, no doubt, that He wants to oblige us to discover that His love for us is not based on our virtue, but springs spontaneously from His heart. He wants to make us realize that there is no danger that His love will undergo change, inasmuch as it does not depend on what He finds in us. Our Lord used to say to Saint Catherine of Siena, "Become a capacity to receive, and I will become a torrent." That's the prayer of the beggar, of the sinner. He must become a capacity to receive. 16. Because vim magnes. Lie those who know God pray well. If we want to pray more effectively, we must seek to know God better. He has taken care to direct our search, by revealing to us that He is love. But what is this love? Its reflection, in those who love us, enables us to glimpse it. By contrast, its caricature, in those who love us badly, also helps us to understand it better. Such has been the experience of a woman, abandoned by her husband, who has recently written to me. I am copying her letter for you. The possessive love of this husband for his wife, strangely enough, brings out the personal character and generosity of God's love. H.C. He did not love me. He loved the woman in me, or more precisely, my femaleness. I was a specimen of femininity that was congenial to him. But when he discovered that I was somebody, when he encountered my me, he was annoyed, not knowing what to do with a me, with a living person. From that moment, there was something in his life that was superfluous, cumbersome. Something, or rather somebody, who denied him the right to be alone, alone with a thing of his very own, somebody who affirmed rights, and first of all the right to be recognized as a unique, one of a kind person. That was just too much. He backed away. It was as if he felt threatened in his own territory. He came to think of me as an intruder. I had taken the liberty to be a person, when he was asking me to be an inanimate object, a pleasant, comfortable specimen of femininity. He strayed. He looked elsewhere. And one day he found another woman who, at least so he thinks, is willing to be his thing. After cruelly dark months, during which I alternated between rage and depression, when every possible temptation assailed me, I can no longer blame him. Today I am at peace, or rather I am possessed by peace. And I owe it all to him. Through my suffering as a badly loved wife, I was led to discover God's love for me. Now I know that God, for his part, does not love me as a little specimen of humanity because he loves humanity, but because I'm Agnes. God is not like the sun, which gives forth its heat indiscriminately and impassably to all creatures. God gives me his love, he gives me himself, because I'm me. God is not like a certain social worker who loves the poor, but never takes the time to look at each one of them in the eye, or to know the name of each person she is helping. What would be the use of it? What she loves is the poor. God is not like that at all. He loves me, Agnes, and he loves me because I'm Agnes. He knows me by my eternal name. He calls me by my name. He is impatient for my answer. He is not jealous of my autonomy or of my personhood. They are dear to him. Of what value would my response be without them? For God, I am not a thing which he preempts to be used, but a freedom that surrenders itself, and for which he has infinite respect. Thanks to God's love, I am reconciled with myself and with others. God has released the wellsprings of tenderness within my heart. Now at last I am living. And the hour of prayer is also the hour of most intense living for me.